from London, BBC Caribbean Report.
The banana giant Chiquita is facing a takeover from a Panamanian company. Kennedison James convinced Dominicans that they never had it so good under his government. And was the millennium bug all hype or a prediction yet to come true? I'm Oren Gordon, and this is BBC Caribbean Report. A group of Panamanian investors have acquired nearly 7% of the American banana multinational Chiquita, and they might make a move to buy the entire company. Chiquita, stung by falling fruit prices worldwide, has seen its stock fall to less than 10% of what it was worth 8 years ago. As Leslie Goff reports, Chiquita's troubles have enticed the Panamanian-based Consolidated Fruit Corporation to target the American banana giant.
According to a document filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission on December 27th, Consolidated Fruit Corporation, a Panama-based group formed recently with the sole purpose of buying Chiquita stock, has talked with Chiquita and with its main shareholder, the Carl Lindner family, about, quote, possible acquisition, business combination, joint venture, or other strategic transaction. The Panama Investment Group, which is led by Samuel Luis Navarro, who owns several banana farms in Costa Rica, and which also includes among its investors Banco del Istmo, one of the largest private domestic banks in Panama, has bought about 3.2 million Chiquita shares during the last 60 days, at prices ranging from $3.42 to $4.10 per share. And though Chiquita has denied that it plans to sell out, New York lawyer Spencer Klein, who represents the Panamanian investors, says a sale is very likely.
We understand from previous discussions with Chiquita or with AFG, its controlling stockholder, that they may be interested in selling the company and may consider undertaking an auction process through which they would sell the company. And we disclose in our filing that we may be interested in participating in that process if they did so.
As a result of Consolidated Fruit's interest in Chiquita, the banana giant stock rose in value, at least for a while. After the Panamanian investors filed their stock ownership last week with the Securities and Exchange Commission, as companies are required to do when their investment exceeds 5%, Chiquita's stock, which had been priced at barely $4 a share, rose as high as $5.75 a share, before collapsing again to today's figure of only $4.13. The BBC Caribbean Report, this is Leslie Goff in New York.
John McMillan is a food industry analyst with the New York financial firm Prudential Securities. He told me that Chiquita's shares were trading at such a low value because its profits have been falling steadily for 7 years.
You go back to the start of this decade where Chiquita's shares were over $50 a share. They were making good money. Now with the stock, you know, down below five, it reflects the fact that you've had seven terrible years of earnings trends.
What are we to read into this particular business deal? Is this a sign that the head of Chiquita, Carl Lindner, thinks it's no longer worth staying in the banana business?
No, I think this is a hostile move done by a businessman who understands the value of Chiquita. I don't think this purchase was a solicitation on the part of Mr. Lindner, nor do I believe that he is privately auctioning the company off. I think this is a businessman who bought some stock at higher prices. The stock dropped. He purchased over 5% and then made some noise to try to make his investment look better, which it has. The stock's gone up in the last week.
Well, the fact is, banana prices have been falling. Fruit distributors in the UK, banana farmers in the Caribbean and Latin America, they all say they've been feeling the pinch. Could it not be argued that Chiquita hasn't managed to escape that either?
Oh, absolutely. Chiquita's been annihilated over the last 7 years with losses that have been severe. If you do it on a pre-tax basis since 92, include charges, the company's probably lost over $250 million. They certainly have felt the pinch. And so have shareholders that have watched the stock drop from at around $50 a share to below $5 while the market kept going up and up. They have certainly felt the pinch.
John McMillan of Prudential Securities. The sugar crop in Trinidad and Tobago is under threat from cane farmers. They're threatening to leave their cane in the fields if government does not pay an outstanding debt of just under $2.4 million. The executive of the Trinidad Islandwide Cane Farmers Association will on Thursday meet with the agriculture minister in the hope of settling the old debt. Over 200,000 people depend on the sugar industry in Trinidad. Tony Fraser reports.
Last year, the farmers agreed to sell their canes at the rate that has existed for the last 4 years. The compromise was that the government would pay them a bonus of over $20 million based on the quality of canes supplied. But at the end of the 1999 crop, the over 6,000 farmers collected only $4.5 million in bonus. The sugar company and the government said the other $15 million could not be paid as the quality of canes was not up to standard. However, the farmers have countered that while they delivered the canes as requested, the canes were allowed to remain at the scales and on the factory floor for up to 72 hours because of problems with scales and the mills at the factory. Therefore, the farmers are saying the fault lies with the company and not with them, and they want their monies. Chief Executive Officer of the sugar company, Karani 1975 Limited, Sharma Lala, acknowledges the contentions of the farmers. But that's not good enough for TICFA President Rafiq Shah and his farmers. They say if the $15 million is not paid, they could decide to leave their canes in the field. Farmers now produce 60% of all canes ground by the sugar factory. If the money is not paid and the farmers do not cut their canes, it would be impossible for Karani to achieve its target of 120,000 tons of sugar for this year. And if the target is not met, it could be the end of the projections for Karani's viability by the year 2002. The sugar company is now carrying a debt of $658 million. This debt has accumulated in the last 5 years after a previous government wrote off $2 billion in debt. The outcome of the meeting on Thursday between the agriculture minister and the farmers is vital for sugar and the economy of Trinidad and Tobago, as sugar makes a significant contribution to foreign exchange earnings. Tony Fraser in Port of Spain for BBC Caribbean Report.
Election talk is in the air in Dominica after the Prime Minister's New Year's Day announcement of a snap poll at the end of this month. The opposition parties are having to play catch-up. Neither the Labour Party nor the Freedom Party was ready with its full slate of candidates. The newspaper columnist Gordon Morrow told me that the announcement is not as sudden as it appears because the government has been talking since last year about taking electoral advantage of some economic improvements.
They believe, since they came into office in 95, they believe they have done enough to convince the population that they should get another term. Certainly some schools have been built, a market has been built, they have maintained the roads, constructed others. They have begun some major projects, including, for instance, a seawall on Point Michel Soufriere. They have put in place certain agricultural incentives aimed towards diversification and home building incentives. They have increased pensions, you know, things of this nature. And perhaps to they had a perception that there's a lack of preparedness on the part of the minority parties. Certainly, only the ruling party had announced all its candidates, all 21 candidates here as the minority parties, the two of them, neither of them had, in fact, announced all.
So for the improvements that you say that the government has delivered, are the Dominican voters going to reward them for that?
They could. In terms of the popular vote, the three parties split the popular vote equally, almost equally, last elections, so that no matter what they do and how well they have performed, there would still be a sizable number of people in terms of the popular vote that could go to either of the two parties, regardless of what they do. I think some people will bear that in mind and others will not, as simple as that. In terms of the ministers in office, I think certainly the Prime Minister will hold his seat relatively easily, the Minister for Communication and Works, I think the Minister of Finance too. The Minister of Agriculture, maybe not so certain from what I'm hearing, you know, and things like that. So it's still very fluid.
I know you don't have a culture of public opinion polling, but what's the sense you get of the way this is likely to go?
If anything, at this point in time, if I had to be so bold as to venture an opinion, I think the ruling party may still get more seats than anybody else, any other single party, that is.
But is it conceivable that this snap election call by the Prime Minister could backfire?
It could. Anything is possible. But I think at this point, at this time, I would tend to give them the edge.
Dominican newspaper columnist Gordon Moreau. You're listening to BBC Caribbean Report. Computer experts in the Caribbean have been among those reporting that the millennium bug has largely failed to bite. As one Trinidad newspaper put it, the Y2K problem turned out to be a damp squib rather than the explosive time bomb many people thought it would be. But the experts say there could be more to come, as Ken Richards reports.
Even the bugs fail to bite. That's how Britain's Independent on Sunday highlights the fact that the dreaded millennium bug didn't materialize and the anticipated problems remained more perception than reality. As Trinidad's Express newspaper puts it, it is clear that fears about what the Y2K problem would have done were more unreal than substantial. The year 2000 computer bug left experts around the world sitting on their hands with little to do. Some have been congratulating themselves that the $500 billion global cost of Y2K readiness was well spent. But Chris Aline, chief executive officer of Sunbeach, one of the Caribbean's leading internet service providers, believes that governments around the world spend too much money on an apparently non-existent problem.
Personally, I think that it's one of the cons of the century. I think that a lot was made of it, a lot of hype was sort of put forward, and a lot of people made a lot of money out of it.
There were a few embarrassing episodes. The website for the U.S. Naval Observatory, America's official timekeeper, showed the year as 1900 for several hours before officials spotted the problem. In another incident, a computer linked to radiation monitoring devices at a Japanese nuclear plant failed, but it was not a critical problem. No nuclear missiles were accidentally launched, and no planes fell from the sky at midnight on December 31st. The consulting firm Gartner Group maintains that the reason things were stable is because of the money spent and the preparations made to avoid worldwide calamity. Chris Aline concedes there was need to pay some level of attention.
Well, obviously there was some, it was right that there should be some degree of concern about it. I think that it was blown way out of proportion.
But there is the view that the Y2K problem was neither fictional nor a matter of mere hype or hysteria. And some experts are warning that it may be too early to count the chickens just yet. The fact remains, however, that clocks in computers all over the world switched over at the turn of the millennium without incident, and it proved almost impossible to find a major Y2K incident.
Ken Richards, well, it may be 4 days into the new year, but the question is still being asked. Where were you when the century ended? Emma Joseph, for one, was highly placed, with a high-rise view from the roof of Bush House.
New Year's Eve morning and Sydney Harbour is ablaze with fireworks. I'm just waking up and they're seeing in the 21st century already. If Sydney looked like that, then London would be mind-blowingly brilliant, I thought. What with our Millennium Wheel and the Dome, London would go down in history as Millennium City. Both landmarks are fantastic sites, but both were in trouble just hours before the big event. The Dome organisers had still not sent out the invitations to over half the guests specially invited to the Queen's Millennium Party. Then it was discovered that the Millennium Wheel had a technical fault, and it would not, as promised, be in use on the big night. But that didn't dampen the festive spirit. Okay, I didn't get an invitation from Her Majesty, and, well, I wasn't lucky enough to win a ticket to go on the wheel. But I, like 3 million others, did have a free ticket to the River Thames fireworks party. A few hours later, I was waiting anxiously on the top floor of the Bush House building to see what promised to be the event of the century. Having just seen the splendour with which Paris saw in the new year, I kept thinking, yeah, but they don't have a river of fire. They don't have zillions of pounds of fireworks like we in London do. As Big Ben struck midnight, the sky exploded with fireworks. Fantastic lights of all colours flashed across London for what seemed like an eternity. 3 million of us stood trance-like and marvelled, but we were all waiting for one thing. The river of fire. Where was the river of fire that would shoot down the Thames at over 700 miles an hour? That question was being asked by everyone when the fireworks came to an end. Did everyone blink and miss it? For days, everyone in this jolly old town walked around puzzled. It turned out that yes, the river of fire did work, but because it was so rapid and spanned 6 miles, no one on the river saw it. That just about summed up London. 3 million of us trooped down to see what we thought would be one of the most memorable experiences of our lives. But most of us were left wondering, why have something that only a man on Mars might be able to see?
Emma Joseph reminiscing. We're back live and direct this century at 11:05, 11:15, and 12:10 GMT for our next morning programs. But before we go, here's a reminder.
This and our other programs can be accessed on our internet website at www.bbc.co.uk/Caribbean.
Ren Gordon saying goodbye.